How safe is the water? Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Last month, we found out that Tacoma found high levels of lead in 13 schools. So we want to know, how safe is the water in the rest of Washington's public schools? The answer is, many districts don't know. They're not testing for lead, and they're not required to. Associated Press asked every Washington school district whether they test their water. They heard back from a little more than half. Out of those, 40% do not test for lead. AP reporter Donna Blankenship is with us live. Welcome to KUOW, Donna.
Thanks, Bill.
Why don't these schools know what's in their water?
Well, the state law and federal law do not require them to test. There is a law that was passed by the legislature asking them to start testing, but the law was put on hold until the legislature could find the money to pay for it.
What was the debate around whether money ought to be found to pay for lead testing?
Well, it was right in the middle of the recession in 2009, and there was a lot of debate in the legislature over funding for all kinds of things.
Right. So the idea was, don't require something of schools that we're not going to pay for ourselves?
That's right. It was a part of a debate on unfunded mandates, and lead testing was part of a bigger law that would have required all kinds of health and safety testings. The State Department of Health thought it was a good idea, and they estimated at that time that it would cost $45 million, something around there, to do all the different tests from mold to lead.
Right. So what we end up with, it sounds like, is districts who can afford to test might test. You reported this is a bigger problem in rural Washington.
That's what we found. Of course, we don't know what the districts that didn't respond to our requests are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But in just less than 2 weeks, we were able to hear back from more than 170 out of the 295 districts.
And why is it more difficult or unpalatable for some districts to test for lead?
I think it's more difficult in the small districts that have very little discretionary money. A big district might have a pocket of money for emergencies or special projects. A small district has to make a choice. Are they going to pay for another teacher or pay for something else?
So what's your sense now after Flint, Michigan, and then this testing in Tacoma? What's your sense as to whether Washington State lawmakers are going to say, okay, we'll pay for testing, lead testing at a state level, now that it's in the news?
Well, I think when a project is in the news, it gets to be a much bigger deal, and the governor's also called for this money to come forward. I know that school districts around the state are getting phone calls today because they're calling me to complain about this, and I think that lawmakers are going to be getting a lot of phone calls saying that they should pay for this. So political pressure is what makes Olympia move.
Right. We're talking how much money?
We don't know exactly how much because the last estimate was made in 2009. At that time, they estimated $5 million just for the lead testing. We have about 1 million school kids, a little more than that, in our state in public schools. And so that's $5 a kid.
Right. $5 a kid, $5 million. Remind us how that fits into the big state budget.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me that question.
You don't need to give me numbers, but it sounds like a relatively small amount.
It's a relatively small amount. The state budget is almost $40 billion.
Okay. So what should parents do if they are, you say you're getting phone calls. What does a parent do if they're concerned about their kids' school water?
If parents are concerned, they should call their school district, but they should also call their state lawmaker.
Right, right. We have, and just for some perspective here, water is not the only place where lead can come and poison a person.
Of course, yeah. I talked to some experts who said really the bigger issue is lead in paint, and lead in paint at home is still a big issue in houses that were built before the 70s, or there's a certain point in the 70s. But that same lead paint was also used in public schools, and one expert told me that it would make even more sense for school districts to replace all the old windows in their buildings because old windows probably have lead paint, and that paint dusts off every once in a while. So if they replace the windows, they eliminate most of that problem.
If you weren't thinking about lead before now, we're certainly thinking about it more these days. That's Associated Press reporter Donna Blankenship joining us live on The Record. Thank you, Donna.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Reporting to us that 40% of Washington public schools that responded to an Associated Press inquiry have not tested for lead in the water and aren't required to. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Talking about health and safety of another kind now. The way it is right now, most outreach workers will not go into the jungle, the homeless encampment under I-5, where 400 people are living. Even city-funded outreach workers stay away because of safety concerns. That's about to change. The mayor's office is going to announce some kind of new approach to the jungle. When that's going to happen and how, the city's not saying yet. But city council member Sally Bagshaw has three ideas. Number one, an alternative where these people can go.
We need to have space, 24/7 space, where people can go. If we think we're going to go up and clean that out, we've got to have places to be able to offer for people to go. You can't just expect them to, you know, hop in their truck and drive off to some other city. They don't have a truck. They don't have a place to go. So we've got to make sure that we've got sanctioned places for people to be. A second is we need to have more mental health beds because a lot of the folks that are in there have mental health issues. And lastly, we definitely need to have more treatment for drug addiction because the stuff that's driving people crazy is the garbage that we are seeing on the streets that are left behind, the needles that are left behind, and the cycle that folks who are in addiction get themselves into. And that treatment facility is probably the thing that we are lacking right now the most that could really make a difference for the safety of the rest of our city as well. We really need a person-centered, individual-centered plan. And the mayor's office is prepared to do that.
We talked with a person who works with homeless people on Capitol Hill and downtown. Jackie St. Louis is his name, and he told us you've been talking about other services being available for people now under the freeway. He talked about reasons why living there might be the least bad option for people.
Folks may be in there for a year, more than that, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. It's a community that they have forged out in existence there, and it becomes home, just like we get emotionally and psychologically attached to places that we call home. These individuals, you know, have a vested interest in staying there.
What else are you going to offer those people who are there because it's the least bad option?
Yeah, well, you know, that, Bill, is exactly, that's the point. What are you going to offer them? Well, we could offer them another space for a sanctioned encampment. There's space at the Othello encampment as an example, right? And there isn't, again, there is not a one-size-fits-all thing. We are not going to be able to say to everybody who's living there, hey, we've got the perfect place for you, you know, come along. We have to balance what we're trying to do in the city with both compassion towards those individuals and public safety for the people that are living around them. You know, Beacon Hill, for example, has told us, Yesler Terrace residents have told us that they find people in their backyards, you know, using their hoses, breaking into cars, stealing things out of their homes because that's the addiction cycle. People need money. They need things. They take the things. They sell the things. They turn the things into the drug of choice, and then the cycle begins again. And there's not one of those simple answers where you can say, hey, we're going to pick everybody up from underneath the freeway and take them someplace else. But we do know if we can find permanent spaces for them with the services they need, we can begin to tackle this problem.
As you know, some shelters don't work for everyone. KUOW, yeah. We met this woman, Cassidy Sweezy, who has a partner and pets and says there's no place we can all stay together.
Yeah.
Is the city changing policies like that?
Yes, we have to. And again, it's not just us that's changing policies. If you talk to cities across the nation that are making faster progress than we are, we have to recognize that putting somebody in a shelter for a 10 or 11 hour stay, separating them from their partner, loved one, and pet is not going to work. So San Francisco has something called the Navigation Center. I'm going down to take a look at that Friday with a group of people. But it's a 24/7 shelter set up by the city, and individuals can go there and they can stay there day and night. They have lockers. That is their bed. They can come back to their bed. And in exchange for having that commitment, the city also provides the kind of services, mental health, and that is the kind of thing San Francisco has done successfully. In 1 year, they've moved over 300 people up into permanent housing, and that's what we need.
We've been talking about many sides of homelessness here. I just want to now circle back to this one spot off Beacon Hill under I-5. When you talk about getting more services in there, are you trying to get people out of the jungle,
yes,
or are you trying to make the living environment in there better?
Well, candidly, I think we need to do both those things. Short term, we should make the living environment better. Long term, again, this is where the police, the fire, the neighbors are coming in. We need to be able to say, people who are here, if we can offer them better places to be, we need to offer them better places to be. And I don't think we can come in and just sweep them out. That is not going to work.
Councilmember Sally Bagshaw chairs Seattle's Human Services and Public Health Committee. The city's going to announce a new approach to the homeless encampment under I-5, commonly known as the jungle. Bagshaw says the mayor's office plans to contract with the Union Gospel Mission to get services in there. They're also planning to clean up trash and needles and human waste. And Bagshaw says all of this will start here in the coming weeks. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It's the lunch hour. Are you eating something that you prepared? Nah, I didn't think so. June Jolie is not surprised either. She's a Bellevue-based food ethnographer. She studies the eating customs of different cultures and people. This is how Americans eat.
So there's breakfast, lunch, dinner, but there's also before breakfast snack, between breakfast, lunch snack, and then between lunch and dinner snack, and then after dinner snack, and then late night. So eight occasions. We measure who, what, where, you know, and lunch at work is the most dissatisfying.
Lunch at work, the most dissatisfying American meal. She is not the only researcher saying that. NPR reported that only 1 in 5 American workers takes a lunch break away from their desks. June Jolie says this is partly because we don't have access to fresh food, partly because in some workplaces there's no kitchen or designated eating place, but really, the sad, shrinking American lunch hour is about a bigger issue.
As a society, as a culture, we don't value the lunch hour anymore. So what typically happens is people look at your schedule and they see that, you know, between 12 and 1, it's open. So what we're seeing is a lot of meetings being scheduled during the lunch hour, the typical lunch hour. So it could be that you're on a conference call, even if you're working at home.
So lunch is the worst. How did we get to this point?
We're working more, and women are working more. We're spending more time outside of home in general. So there's been this sort of shift in food culture from a cooking culture or a cook's culture to an eating culture. And so it used to be just a generation ago, if mom cooked, you know, you showed up, you ate what she put in front of you, what she had prepared, and there's no buts about that, right? But now what we're finding is there's typically not that many cooks in the home. So mom or dad or kids might not be cooking. And so once we start devolving from a cooking culture, we are now evolving into an eating culture. And so I think there's just less focus on planning, preparation, you know, and so when you don't have plans made and you're not thinking about what you're going to have for the next meal, it's you don't know what you're going to eat until you're hungry. That's what we found. Oh, I'm hungry. I gotta get lunch.
Isn't there a beauty in that, though? I make it up every day. I had Korean today, you know, tomorrow I might have something different. I'm lucky enough to work near fair amount of options on the Ave.
Yeah, there's actually a beauty in it because it frees up time. It frees up certainly cooking time, cleaning time, and then we're also free to eat about, like eat different types of food. So, you know, eating outside of our family really leads to food exploration and discovery. So, yeah, there is a little bit of beauty to it as well. It's not all sad.
Sure, a lot of oil and sodium in those restaurant meals, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are you advocating?
Well, you know, like culture, it's pretty complex. It's less about exactly what you eat, and it's more about how you eat that makes a difference. Tons of snacky type foods, right, you can have for lunch. But, you know, when it comes to creating bonds at work, creating social relationships, and just giving yourself a break in the day, I think it's wonderful. So I think it's thinking about it. We should be a little bit more mindful and decide, is this what we want, rather than being reactive? Because it's pretty important. It's a pretty important time to nourish yourself and give yourself a break and just reconnect with something other than the computer.
Doesn't a longer lunch mean I just got to spend more time at work? If I can eat while I work, I can get to my kids sooner. I can get to whatever it is faster.
Yeah, that is what it means. But the other side of it is everybody has their computer open. You know what? If everybody took lunch, nobody would be working during that hour, and we wouldn't miss that extra hour of productivity. And maybe it's not so much productivity. Maybe we're, you know, kind of wasting our time. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe there's an undiscovered opportunity.
Right.
It's time for us to remember.
Right. It's just like when we have a holiday, you know, the emails all slow down. The inbox isn't so cluttered because we're all taking a national rest. So what about just a national little, you know, a little beat to rest during the day?
You are a food ethnographer. Are there mm-hmm. other cultures besides American culture, Seattle culture, that approach lunch very differently than we ought to think about?
Oh, yeah. I think we're kind of the worst, and we're leading the charge in other countries. So when I did some field work in Mexico, one of the guys was telling me, you know, there's 20 people standing behind me who want my job, so I can't take the traditional Mexican lunch hour or two. So I think it's a condition of modern working and modern living and commuting and
global competition.
Global competition, certainly. But then there are other countries that do it differently. So in China, in Korea, in France, they eat together. So even if it's not provided for them, although the company will often subsidize in Korea, they all leave together. And in fact, when I was working in Korea, I brought my little snacky things for lunch because, you know, that's what I do, right? And I started eating it at the desk. And they said, "What are you doing? What are you eating at your desk?" And they, you know, kind of forced me.
Like, that's weird.
That's weird, right. In China, I think that there's a lot of cafeterias there, and so they do eat together communally as well.
Do you think we can, as a culture, start to change the lunch hour, take it back?
Yes.
From sadness?
Yes, we should start a campaign and take back our lunch hour. I think so.
How would that happen? How would that start?
I think we just need to, you know, it could even be one person in a company or a couple, and just start eating lunch together, even if it's, you know, awkward or odd or and just start talking about it. But certainly companies who get to decide these things can do some, can support their employees.
That's June Jo Lee, a Bellevue-based food ethnographer, arguing that American workers need more support so you can take back your lunch hour. Peter Miller's on board with that. He is a boss. He owns Peter Miller Books near Pike Place Market, and every day at lunchtime, he and his employees prepare a meal and eat it together.
If you take that break, the afternoon becomes a separate segment. You're refreshed. You know, it's a little bit like washing your face and hands. Everything, just for a moment, felt better. I mean, when they give you the warm towel with on the plane, you're always surprised that this stupid little towel made such a difference.
So how does lunch go in your company?
The night before, you know, it's sort of an act of what we call cooking over the shoulder of a meal, where you actually say, well, look, I'm already making the pasta. I could certainly throw another half pound of pasta in here. The water's already boiling. All I'm going to do is throw it away. I'm going to sit down to dinner. I'll throw a little extra pasta in for tomorrow, or I'll make a little more pasta, or, you know, I have half a chicken left, or whatever it is. You can make extra rice. So you the night there is some task of keeping in mind and planning for it. And then the next day, we simply look at the situation. Somebody, usually me or someone, will say, you know, I brought this or I brought this. Whereas only two or three of us, so we're quite quick. Maybe somebody stopped at the market or, you know, we texted someone and said, would you grab some two lemons or would you grab some lettuce or, you know, whatever.
Every day. You're making lunch every day?
You make lunch every day. While it sounds to someone saying, geez, I'm not going to make lunch every day, once you actually have this system in place, you're already, if you have rice left over, trying to figure out what you're going to do with it the next day.
Sure, but especially if you have permission from the boss, encouragement from the boss.
Sure. There's a very interesting democracy to eating and certainly to lunch. And when you go to lunch, there's a kind of starting line in which it's very democratic. Everyone has the same status. Some people might be quite good at lettuce. Some people might be quite good at something else. Some people might have brought something that was quite good. It may be that the person of the most power in terms of the office
is, in fact, me. Company.
But we've had people come visit who have been quite meek in their power of sitting at lunch because that's not what they're good at. They don't. They can't make a salad dressing. Or
do you
they
feel,
can't.
Is that a dynamic at work that that during lunchtime, all of a sudden maybe the hierarchy
is a different hierarchy than a work hierarchy.
They're not making any more money.
No,
but they're on top.
If they can cook. Right.
In my workplace, we're eating takeout and eating at our desk. A lot of us.
All of you.
You're getting less work done, though, right?
You mean because we're gobbling up so much time making our lunch? No, I think we probably are done in 20 minutes.
Okay.
You know, I think we put it down, we tell stories, it's a thing. Sometimes people will take it and go to their desk because they have something they have to get out. A lot of it has really surprised me. The food is better, obviously. If I make you a salad and you bought the salad that was made in Tukwila this morning at 6 a.m., I'm not going to lose that race.
Right.
I mean, I'll win that. The food is better because it's made right then. We really only allow 15 minutes to make the food, and only one person goes down there to get it all ready. And then everybody shows up, sits down, we eat, we talk, we're done, boop. The person who really can't cook cleans up, and we're back at work.
And what's the surprising effect for you? It does what to you besides give you a nice lunch and 20 minutes with your colleagues?
The surprising effect, and you know, no one's ever said it, but I know every person that, I mean, when I run a bookstore, they don't make any money. Every one of them is pleased that at the end of the week, there's $50 they didn't spend for lunch. And they know it. It's as if you gave them a whole free transport system. And that's important. But that added to the food, added to the fact that you actually, for a minute, sat with everybody and someone said, oh, I had a terrible night or blah, 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 which something they won't say otherwise. It's an out of time. It's an interesting privacy that you then, at the end of the day, go back to your own privacy. But it creates its own world, just for a second.
Peter Miller owns Peter Miller Books near Pike Place Market. He's the author of Lunch at the Shop. It's a cookbook of the lunch recipes he and employees make in the bookstore kitchen every day. We're talking about the lunch hour on Twitter right now. At KUOW, hashtag tweeting while eating. Now, you could just pry open somebody's trash bin or wash an apple in a stream, like the subject of our next story. Have you heard about the raccoon? If you are one of the almost 40,000 Seattleites who suddenly lost power early this morning, you have a nocturnal mammal to blame. One of them wobbled into a City Light substation near Ballard before 3 a.m. and did something. Then there was an explosion and a power outage from Magnolia to Fremont, Ballard to Queen Anne, and reportedly the raccoon survived. Now, we've told you about the threat of a cyber terrorist taking down our power grid, but a terrorist who can wear a permanent mask, open your bin, eat your garbage, stand on its hind legs, give you rabies, and switch off thousands of coffee makers at once and live? Well, the power is back on, but I think we're learning what every small house cat already knows. This is the raccoon's world. You live in it until they decide otherwise. KUOW's The Record. It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. Canadian Liberals celebrated when Justin Trudeau was elected Prime Minister, but the newish Canadian government has its first big fallout with the left. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer is here to tell you about it. Vaughn, why are human rights groups calling on Trudeau to cancel a weapons sale to Saudi Arabia?
New government inherited a deal from the old government, and it's a big one. $15 billion worth of light armored vehicles. They would be made in Canada. They would be shipped to Saudi Arabia over the next 14 years, and they'd create 2,000 jobs here in the interim. Nevertheless, the government's being called on to stop it. Human rights advocates point to Saudi Arabia having one of the worst human rights records in the world. And they also note that the Saudi government, in fact, they this week produced videos showing it, has been using similar light armored vehicles against its civilian population. So the critics are saying that Canada's own export rules say you don't export weapons to places where they'll be used against the civilian population of that country. So they're accusing the government, essentially, of being in violation of its own rules.
Yes, these videos appear to show Saudi Arabian armored vehicles firing on Shia Muslim dissidents in that country. We should say vehicles not made by Canada, right?
That's right. They're not our vehicles. We haven't started shipping ours there yet, but they're similar. There's also an allegation that the Saudis will use these in Yemen, where they're also engaged in military action. It's a tough call for a government. Saudi Arabia is officially an ally of Canada. 14,000 Saudis attend university in Canada. Supposedly they're on our side, I guess you'd say it. I guess the United States wrestles with the same issue from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, part of the problem is the thing you referred to right off the top, Bill, which is that this government came into office promising a more ethical approach to international affairs. Canada was going to go back to being the Boy Scout of the world. And to some degree, they've been caught out here by the trade-off between sometimes you have allies that are hard to justify and hard to deal with. And, of course, sometimes governments sign arms deals that are very, very important to jobs and economic growth. I mean, this is a big deal for Canada. $15 billion, 2,000 jobs, then you're forced out there to have to justify who you're selling the stuff to.
Yes, and as you say, human rights groups in this country have long criticized American arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Is the Saudi government reacting at all? They tend to be pretty secretive.
They're organizing Saudi-Canada Friendship Days. They're making a big public relations push here, and as I say, there's an awful lot of Saudi students here. That's probably a big cash flow into Canada as well, that we have 14,000 students here. And, you can imagine some of the opinion pieces you've seen in Canadian papers. Some people have been pointing out there are worse places in the Middle East than Saudi Arabia. You could make a pretty good case that the Iranian regime has a worse record. The tensions in the region are well documented, and the groups that the Saudi government is using these weapons against are trying to abolish the monarchy and destabilize the country. I don't think you need to be much of a friend of Saudi Arabia to recognize that would destabilize the entire global economy, given the central importance of Saudi Arabia to both the Middle East and also to the world supply of oil.
So finally on this, Vaughn, you have critics saying that this sale might not even be legal under Canada's own rules about who it exports weapons to. You have the government saying it's, as you say, good for jobs, good, this is an ally. What's going to happen next?
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens next, Bill, because the videos you just referred to were just obtained yesterday by the Globe and Mail newspaper. It's reported on their front page today. They have not had it out with the government yet on the latest evidence, so we're sitting around waiting for the head boy scout, the prime minister, to say what he thinks of the new evidence or whether or not the government's going to dismiss it. Bill, they've said Canada said they checked all this out already, and they weren't worried about violating the export rules, so I guess they'll have to look at the new evidence and decide whether that changes their minds. I will be surprised if it does. I think the government's going to go ahead of this for economic reasons and for reasons of alliance as well.
Okay, we'll wait for what the head Boy Scout has to say about it. Finally, I just want to catch up with that giant fire in Alberta that evacuated a whole city, 88,000 people. What's the latest?
The Premier of Alberta toured Fort McMurray yesterday. She said the damage is pretty bad, 2,400 homes and structures destroyed, but about 90% of the city survived. They have to get the fire under control. Of course, that's also, Bill, in the center of the oil production in the province of Alberta. It's been out for a few days, but that's coming back as well. So it's a terrible story, but, you know, it sounds like the only really inspiring part of it is it seems that the community has pulled together remarkably well there, and there have been some very stirring kind of human stories about the one everybody quotes is the firefighter who watched his own house burn to the ground and then put in an 18-hour shift fighting the forest fire to try to save his neighbor's places.
Wow. Okay, we just have 1 minute, Vaughn. Just briefly, what do we know about what caused this fire?
Extremely dry forests, a very, very fast-moving fire. No sense of really blaming anybody. British Columbia has had some fires in that region this year, and there have been reports here of 10 fires started by arson, which are being investigated. The Alberta one just turns out to be one of the biggest natural disasters in that province's history.
Thanks for catching us up, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Always good to talk with you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in here to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Won't you take a trip with me now, 25 years into the past? 1991. Remember what that sounded like?
Everybody dance now! You got a smile so bright. You know you could have been a candle. Holding you so tight, you know you could. Don't tell me it's not worth trying for. You can't tell me it's not worth dying for. Call you every night and give you flowers too.
Thanks, Naughty by Nature, and Bryan Adams was in there. UB40, CNC Music Factory, Color Me Bad. Maybe you can see why some music critics at the time were saying rock and roll had died. But then this happened. September 1991, and Nirvana's album Nevermind comes out. Unexpected, massive hit. Seattle suddenly known as the epicenter of grunge. Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot co-host a public radio show, Sound Opinions, and Jim DeRogatis started out telling me pop music was bad before Nirvana broke through, but rock and roll was not dead in 1991.
I mean, the cliched shorthand is that, you know, Nirvana came along, kicked Michael Jackson off the top of the charts, you know, and bands like Poison, the hair metal bands. You know, that is a reductive shorthand history that is has very little to do with history. You know, the fact is that for a decade or more, after the initial punk explosion in England and in New York in the mid-70s, there was a vibrant and thriving American underground.
Yeah, I think the Pacific Northwest scene in particular, you know, had a lot of great bands in the 80s that we knew all about and would come out and see them when they would tour, you know, Wipers and Green River and Fastbacks and Melvins. These were great bands, and they just didn't happen to be charting. But rock was alive and very well, including in the Pacific Northwest. It was, to me, more a matter of time. I had a brother-in-law. I still have a brother-in-law who would send me cassette tapes back in the day when cassette tapes were the coin of the realm, filled with the new sounds from Seattle. And I remember hearing bands like Mudhoney and Nirvana in their infancy because of that, and thinking, man, this is great stuff. You know, nobody could predict that this was one day going to be commercially acclaimed music as well as, you know, cult status music, but it happened in a matter of years. And I think, as Jim said, the groundwork had been laid going all the way back to bands like the Ramones and the Clash and the Sex Pistols in the 70s. And I think it was, in a lot of ways, a culmination of all of that.
We remember the Nirvana album Nevermind as touching off the Seattle explosion. Why do you think Nirvana struck such a nerve with youth culture at that time?
Well, Generation X, demographically speaking, people born between, you know, 62 or 64, the sociologists said it at, and the early 80s, you know, are one of the smallest generations of American teens in history, sandwiched between this massive baby boom and the baby boom's offspring, the millennials. And it was a generation without an identity, a generation that felt it had been lied to. We grew up eating our Fruit Loops while having our cartoons interrupted on Saturday morning by the Watergate hearings. We're cynical and jaded. You know, all that slacker stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Richard Linklater's Slacker and Cameron Crowe's Singles filmed in Seattle, right? There's an element of truth there. We weren't going to be bought and sold, or we were going to fight it. And out comes this sound from largely from Seattle, but the rest of America as well, that is real, that is raw, that is authentic. And we connect to it. Now, I remember sitting with Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic and saying, boys, I don't understand. When I bought, you know, Touch Me, I'm Sick by Mudhoney, you know, as the single on Sub Pop, right? I thought this was the song that was going to change the world. You know, why wasn't that song Smells Like Teen Spirit? And they both said to me, honestly, we don't know why Smells Like Teen Spirit was Smells Like Teen Spirit. You know, Mudhoney should have gotten there first, or Kurt would say the Melvins, although he would say that with a smirk because he knew you had to be a little bit, more than a little bit twisted to love the Melvins.
How did big music, how did the major record labels react to the success of the Seattle scene, et cetera?
They were sharks at a feeding frenzy. You know, you're talking about a major label industry that no longer exists anymore, and that to anybody under the age of 30, I think, is they can't even believe that it ever happened that way. If you've been watching HBO's Vinyl, you know, that this kind of big corporate mentality ever existed in rock and roll. You know, but they descended en masse with their platinum Amex cards, taking any musician busking on the street in Seattle out to a $300 dinner and signing them to a recording contract that they would, you know, get this allegedly big advance, but they'd have to pay it all back. You know, the whole thing lasted 2 years. And by 1993, 94, Billboard ran a front page article. Greg and I had an interesting perspective on this because we had been to Seattle. We were both writing about the bands in Seattle. And then 2 years later, Billboard said, the new capital of cool in America, Chicago.
Yeah, you know, the industry is famous for co-opting good ideas, and then once it's co-opted, the idea doesn't become so good anymore. It becomes sort of a sellout notion. And I remember being in Seattle, you know, when Cameron Crowe was filming Singles, and the cynicism, the level of cynicism was just hilarious. I could compile a comedy album based on the response I was getting from various musicians and club owners and record store, owners in Seattle. At the time all of this was going on, they knew it was a passing phase. And at the same time, you've got all these bands that didn't have a prayer of getting played on the radio, commercial radio, completely ignored, you know, for years, even though they were great bands. Bands like the Butthole Surfers, the Jesus Lizard, the Melvins, getting signed to these major label deals. That, to me, was one of the most amazing aspects of this. And then they all got dropped. Two or three albums later, they're off the label.
Yeah, you know, if they're lucky, they got a new station wagon out of it. And
right.
That's about it, you know?
Right, but all this industry, it can't be said enough that in the early 90s, this entire alternative industry developed around, you know, what had been an underground scene for most of the 80s. This scene had been around for years. Lollapalooza, the traveling festival, you know, the movie Singles by Cameron Crowe, the emergence of what became known as the alternative rock radio format. I mean, these kind of things couldn't have been imagined in 1988. And they all came true by 91, 92, 93. And as soon as we started to see this commercial tinge put on the whole thing, that's when it lost all its glow, all its innovation. And it was time to end it.
Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot from Sound Opinions, you guys often will pick a Desert Island Jukebox songs. You can't live without them. So what's a song from the Seattle scene you want to throw in that jukebox, Jim?
Oh, I'm going to go with a Mudhoney song. Like I said, Superfuzz Big Muff comes out. I bought it, you know, at Pier Platters in Hoboken, New Jersey on vinyl, Sub Pop record. I just love that record. I just loved it. And I think the song If I Think, right? I think a lot of this has to do with pronouns. With Kurt, it was here we are now, entertain us, you know. With Mudhoney, it was If I Think, I Think of You. And it was, you know, the humor in that song. First of all, one of the greatest guitar riffs in history, right? And then the humor of saying, you know, if I think, and I'm not saying I do all the time, but on those rare occasions when I think of you. I mean, it's a brilliant lyric. It's a brilliant vocal. It's an incredible guitar riff. And it's got that, you know, it's got that Nirvana formula. You know, the soft, sweet, loud, hard, you know, fast, slow. It's a perfect song.
How about you, Greg?
Well, Mudhoney is a great choice. I love that band. Another band that I loved from Seattle during that era was Screaming Trees. I thought, unbelievable band. And to this day, I still stand by most of their records. Nearly Lost You, to me, is a great song. I just love that. I think it sort of gets the essence of that group, a little psychedelic, propulsive, those great Mark Lanegan baritone vocals. You know, to me, it's a timeless sound. It transcends any way, any tagline or, you know, oh, this is the grunge era. No, this is just a great rock band with a great rock song. And I think, you know, people 20 years from now will be discovering them and saying what a great band this was.
Is there a legacy of the Seattle music that we're talking about?
You know, Lester Bangs in the 70s did this famous three-chord history of rock and roll. It was his thesis that the three chords of La Bamba were the same three chords of Louie Louie, were the same three chords of No Fun by the Stooges, the same three chords of Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones, and today we could add the same three chords of Smells Like Teen Spirit. Each played more nasty each time, each hopefully using that second person plural. We're in this together. Let's make a mess. I want to say lots of curse words here, right? Let's get in trouble is what we're about to do. There's a certain attitude to rock and roll, and it's we don't like the status quo.
Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot are the co-hosts of Sound Opinions, which is coming here to Seattle this Friday, a live show at the Neptune Theater with special guests, Mudhoney. You can touch them. They're sick. We're tweeting out a link to the event right now at KUOW. They're going to tape that show for a future episode of Sound Opinions. And speaking of game-changing albums, this Sunday, Sound Opinion goes back even further. God only knows.
50 years ago this month, Brian Wilson elevated pop music to new artistic heights with the Beach Boys' masterpiece, Pet Sounds.
Wouldn't it be nice?
We celebrate the 50th anniversary of Pet Sounds with a classic album dissection this week on Sound Opinions.
Wouldn't it be nice if you listened to Sound Opinions every Sunday night, 10 o'clock here on KUOW? You know what? Since it is Bernard, almost 80 degrees, right?
It's beautiful out there.
We're headed there. Can we surf a little? Can we go out with a little Southern California?
I don't see why not.
Okay, let's do it.
I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon your hair. Through the air. Come, baby, look.